طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news from Palestine and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal military occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. We ask our listeners, as we do every week, were you involved last week in the Palestine-Israel peace movement and the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's savage military attacks against them to force them out of their homes and annex their properties into Israel? Did you speak out on the atrocities Israel is committing every day in Gaza and the West Bank? If not, why not? What is your reason not to? It is Sunday, April 19th, 2009. We have five event announcements. On Thursday, April 23rd, the Harvard School of Public Health will host a discussion on health in the Palestinian territories, the obstacles of occupation, from 12:30 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. at the Kresge Auditorium, Room G2. On Friday, April 24th, award-winning Palestinian playwright and actress Najla Saeed will perform her one-woman show called Palestine at the Fong Auditorium in Boylston Hall at Harvard University at 6 p.m. The event is free and open to the public. On Saturday, April 25th, the University of Massachusetts at Boston will host a Boston-Palestine Solidarity Strategy Conference starting with registration at 9 a.m. in the Wheatley Building. That is the Wheatley Building. The event will take place in the Wheatley Building and will feature as speakers Dr. Elaine Hagopian, Professor Emerita at Simmons College, Dr. Joel Covell, author of Overcoming Zionism, Boston City Councilor Chuck Turner, Palestinian scholar Omar Badar, Managing Director of the Palestine Cultural Center for Peace, Dr. Sarah Rosh Mahdi, Code Pink activist recently returned from Gaza, Ron Francis, founder of the Somerville Divestment Project, Palestinian writer, teacher, and activist Laila Cable, Daryl Lee, scholar on Palestine and contributor to Middle East Reports and other publications, and many other speakers. The conference will include workshops on all the major topics underlying activist organization for solidarity with Palestine. This is an important conference for activists. On Wednesday, April 29th, the Boston Chapter of American Jews for a Just Peace will host its first annual Hilda Bernstein Silverman Memorial Program with an evening of insight, music, and poetry, celebrating the life of Hilda Silverman, featuring Sandy Tolan, author of The Lemon Tree, An Arab, a Jew, and the Heart of the Middle East. Mr. Tolan will be speaking on visions of a just peace in Israel and Palestine at 7 p.m., at the First Parish Church in Cambridge, Unitarian Universalist, located at the corner of Mass Avenue and Church Street in Harvard Square, Cambridge. Please mark your calendars for this unique event. And on Wednesday, May 6th, the Boston Chapter of American Jews for a Just Peace will be presenting a talk by Jimmy Johnson, International Coordinator for the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. Mr. Johnson is on a speaking tour of the United States after attending the Durban conference. He will be presenting results of ICAD's ongoing investigation into the U.S.-Israeli collaboration on the development and testing of high-tech weaponry in occupied Palestine, and will report on the aftermath of the war on Gaza and the recent Israeli elections. The event will take place on May 6th at 8 p.m. at the Palestine Cultural Center for Peace, located at 41 Quint Avenue in Alston. Please mark your calendars for this important event. Now for a brief summary of news highlights. U.S. Envoy George Mitchell met with Israeli President Shimon Peres, Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman, and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. No word yet on the specifics of what was discussed. President Barack Obama, we have heard, pledge that he would work toward improving relations with Arab countries. During his visit to Turkey 2 weeks ago, he said, quote, "The United States is not and will never be at war with Islam," unquote. Yet Mr. Obama continues to fund and provide weapons for Israel's destruction of the now largely Muslim Palestinian civil society. The killing of Palestinian civilians, either directly with American-supplied arms or indirectly by starvation, disease, and denial of medical care through a choking military siege, and providing political cover for these crimes with a veto in the United Nations Security Council to boot. His UN ambassador, Susan Rice, said in an interview with the Politico that the Obama White House was determined to, in her words, fight against the anti-Israel crap at the United Nations. So now the president is threatening everyone who dares address the issue of Israeli war crimes. Who does Mr. Obama think he is fooling with his pledges and speeches? Mr. Obama is a hypocrite, a silver-tongued hypocrite, to be sure, the most dangerous kind. The only difference between him and the self-declared world emperor George W. Bush is lofty rhetoric. The Israeli press recently published an article claiming that Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and Defense Minister Barak proposed to link any progress on the Palestinian track with American actions to deal with the so-called Iranian threat. Senior American officials are said to have begun talking about Bushehr for Yitzhar. Bushehr is the site of an Iranian nuclear reactor. Yitzhar is the name of a small, ultra-Orthodox settlement of 500 people on top of a steep mountain overlooking the Palestinian village of Asir al-Qibliya near Nablus, the largest Palestinian city in the West Bank. Yitzhar in Hebrew means high-quality olive oil, which the settlers have stolen from Palestinian orchards. The deal is unacceptable on its face. There should be no such deals. All Israeli settlements should be dismantled unconditionally and without any behind-the-scenes secret, quote, understanding, unquote. Mr. Netanyahu posed an additional condition, that the Palestinian Authority must recognize Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state before his government would enter into peace negotiations. This absurd condition would have Palestinians confer legitimacy to Israel's criminal acts of ethnic cleansing and murder for the last 62 years. The Netanyahu government is a racist government at its core, whose foreign minister Avigdor Lieberman is known to have incited Israelis to commit criminal terrorist acts of murder. In a world where international laws are applied equally to all countries, Israel would be a pariah state, the Israeli government would be shunned, and the country would be sanctioned and blockaded. In the West Bank, the ethnic cleansing of East Jerusalem continues at an accelerated pace under the noses of a criminally silent world community. Demolition orders threaten the homes of 1,500 people in the Bustan area of the Silwan neighborhood alone. Avoiding mass demolitions which might spark public attention in Western media, the homes are being stealthily demolished one or two at a time every day. Elsewhere in the West Bank, during a nonviolent demonstration against Israel's annexation wall in the village of Jayus, which has already lost 75% of its agricultural land to the Israeli colonies and is facing additional losses because of a rerouting of the wall surrounding the village, some brave young men broke through the wall and destroyed some wall building materials before escaping back to the village. Israeli soldiers responded by raiding the village with 15 jeeps, fired at residents, imposed a curfew, occupied the village, and fired sound bombs all night long to prevent the villagers from sleeping. The largely Christian village of Beit Sahur near Bethlehem will soon be the target of Israel's insatiable appetite for land expropriation and housing demolition. Beit Sahur is living in the shadow of a military order issued in 2003 by the then chief commander of the Israeli forces occupying the West Bank, a certain General Kaplinsky, in which he declared, quote, "I hereby announce the seizure of land for military purposes," unquote. Just like that. The maps accompanying the order showed how a certain housing project in Beit Zahur would be cut off along with other Palestinian homes and farmlands. The housing project in question was initiated to create affordable housing for young families on land leased from the Greek Orthodox Church. The project consists of 15 buildings, each with 8 privately owned apartments. A community church is still on the drawing board. 64 families now reside in 10 completed buildings. With a few exceptions, they are Greek Orthodox from Beit Zahur. All face forced eviction under the gun and dispossession of their lands. Nonviolent demonstrations against Israel's illegal annexation wall, which started in the village of Bil'ain some 3 years ago, have spread across the West Bank to the villages of Nil'ain, Al-Ma'sara, Wadi al-Rasha, Beit Omar, and Safa. In Nil'ain, Israel's expulsion forces used live ammunition and the Ruger gun, which was outlawed in 2001 by Israel's judge advocate general. We note, however, that Israel's High Court has since given permission to Israel's expulsion forces to use live ammunition aimed at Palestinians' legs. So Israel's august High Court holds that amputation is a fitting price for Palestinians to pay for nonviolent demonstrations. Yesterday, Israeli soldiers shot and killed 30-year-old Bassam Ibrahim Abu Rahma in cold blood during the weekly nonviolent demonstration against the wall in Bil'ain. Mr. Abu Rahma was unarmed. It was a clear case of deliberate, cold-blooded murder. We also note with deep grief that Israel's criminal use of high-tech American-supplied weaponry on the civilian population of Gaza during its 23-day assault resulted in a huge number of amputations performed on innocent adults and children. For many, the amputations were not enough to save their lives. We're very pleased today to welcome Mr. Aswad Simmons as our featured guest. Mr. Simmons recently visited Gaza with a Code Pink delegation and returned last month. He joins us now by telephone. Good morning, Mr. Aswad Simmons.
Good morning, Sharif. How are you?
I am very well, thank you. How about yourself?
I'm doing great, thank you.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine.
Thank you, sir.
You have recently returned from a trip to Gaza, I believe, around March 15th or so?
Correct.
You went with Code Pink. Is there something that motivated you to join Code Pink on its delegation?
I had been in contact with a sister group of theirs, which is Global Exchange. And I was contemplating taking one of their reality tours. And I saw that they were taking a trip to Gaza. Mm-hmm. And I was immediately, I was immediately into it. So I signed up, they accepted me, and I think within 3 or 4 weeks we were heading to Egypt.
So did you have difficulties getting into Gaza?
Say it again?
Did you have any difficulties getting into Gaza?
We didn't. It was pretty amazing. We were at the border for, I would say, an hour and a half to 2 hours max, and we were allowed entry.
Mm. That was through the Rafah crossing?
Correct.
Could you tell us about your trip, where you went, what you saw?
Sure. We pretty much covered the whole Gaza Strip. When we initially got there, we put together, it was International Women's Day, so Medea Benjamin, Gail Murphy, Anne Wright, Chai Berry, we all set up like an assembly line, and we put together over 1,000 baskets. And one evening, with the help of some of the ICRC, I believe their name is, and we put these baskets together, and then the very next day we distributed them throughout a lot of the women's shelters, and I think we visited 10 shelters, and there were about two or three trucks that were doing the deliveries also.
Were the shelters those by operated by the United Nations Work Relief Agency?
Yes, some of them were. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Some of them were, but some of them were Palestinian ran, I believe.
Did you visit Gaza City?
We did. Mm-hmm. We did. We stayed in Al-Quds Hotel, which is not, I think it was maybe a 2 or 3 minute ride by taxi to the center of Gaza City. So we were there a couple times during the 4 days that we were there.
What did you see on your way into the center of Gaza City to the hotel?
Complete destruction. From the moment we crossed the border, we could see the way these people were bombarded. It was just, residential areas just completely destroyed. Completely.
Mm.
It was unlike anything I have ever seen. I've never been into a war zone. But, seeing it on TV, just being there, you don't get the gist of what's really going on until you're amongst the rubble. It's amazing.
Total devastation.
Complete.
Were you able to go to the Jabalia refugee camp?
We did. Mm-hmm. We did. We visited a couple refugee camps. And we distributed some of the aid that we had brought. It's just complete destruction.
Any hospitals? Did you visit any hospitals? The prime hospital in Gaza City is Al-Shifa.
Right.
No.
I'm not sure if we visited Al-Shifa. We did visit Al-Quds, one of the hospitals. Excuse me. That was bombed,
mm-hmm.
and we had heard about. We had spoke with some of the doctors and how they were trying to wheel the patients up the street because, they were bombing the hospital. They bombed the morgue. It was amazing. I do remember that hospital well because it was bombed pretty badly.
Were you able to go up north to Beit Hanun?
I don't think that we made it to Beit Hanun.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. I don't recall. It was, you have to forgive me, Sharif, because I have only been to Bermuda before. This is my first trip abroad. I think some of the other delegates, they were well-traveled. They knew to take notes. This was something that, I felt like I needed to do. And, I was in awe pretty much the whole time. I had never experienced anything like that. So, instead of taking notes, I took over 300 photographs. But that's about the only thing I was really doing, trying to talk with the people and just get an understanding of how they're surviving amongst this devastation.
Was it a life-transforming experience for you?
It was, definitely. Absolutely. I don't think I'll ever be the same. It's making me want to, better myself and stop worrying about some of the things that I've worried about, the small, insignificant. I thought I was raised with a family of seven children. There were eight of us in the household in New York. And we were pretty poor growing up. But this, when you compare the way I was raised to how these children and women and men are living, you can't even compare it. It's like apples and oranges. There's no comparison whatsoever. We were able to eat every single night. I had a bed to sleep, and I was not outside amongst the elements. I had a TV to watch, movies. They have none of that. you know, or what, and the little, it's very little that they do have, if you do find that.
Did you visit any Palestinian home?
Yes. I had the pleasure of, when we had distributed most of the aid, I immediately, these are some of the most humble, welcoming people I have ever met. I had felt more love in God than I felt in a very long time. And they would welcome you right into their home. They would treat you as if you were one of their own. Mm. So that was a blessing. Mm. That was a blessing.
Were you able to go south to the town of Rafah?
Yes, we did. Mm-hmm. When we had got in, we met the mayor. I'm not going to be able to recall his name, but he met us at the, once we got into Gaza, we were at the Gaza border center, and he gave us a speech basically thanking us for coming and calling attention to, you know, the atrocities that were committed over there. So we spent some time in Rafah, I think maybe a day or two. Mm. Rafah.
Yes, the usual excuse or reason the Israelis give is that Hamas was using Palestinian civilians as human shields and hiding their ammunition in homes as the reason for their bombarding the homes, which was utterly ridiculous. They said the same thing in Lebanon. And in Lebanon, as opposed to Gaza, there were many journalists who were there on the ground who gave the lie to what Israel was saying, that there were no arms hidden in Lebanese homes. The same thing applies to Gaza. Did you meet any of the people who went with the British convoy?
We did.
Mm-hmm. Were they there then?
Viva Palestina, yes.
Palestina.
Yes, Viva Palestina, yes. They actually stayed in the, I was in a room with Tyler Westbrook, mm-hmm. and he was a journalist there. And he had the opportunity to interview about three of them. We then, we had spent some time with him in Gaza. I actually met George Galloway at the Rafah border. Mm-hmm. But we met them back in Egypt also.
How was your meeting with George Galloway?
It was unbelievable. I was ecstatic. I've been a George Galloway fan for some time now. And we were leaving Gaza, and I was going to use the bathroom, and I had remembered seeing this gentleman who I'm not sure what his business at the border crossing was, but he looked like he was an official, and I had spoke with him on entry into Gaza, just like briefly. He had asked what we were doing, and I had spoke with him, so he recognized me, and I recognized him, and he told me, you know, he said, you know, George Galloway's in that room right there, so. I kind of stood outside the room and waited for him to come out and asked him if I could get a picture. He was very, very nice man. Very nice guy.
One of the few outspoken UK members of parliament.
That's right.
Is there anything that particularly affected you? Any event, any sight that affected you particularly?
I would say the children.
Mm.
You know, I think that we all know, you know, whatever the reasons that the Israelis use for the war crimes that they commit, and Palestine as a whole, it's, I just, as a human being, I can't see how, you know, somebody can allow for, you know, any people, but children especially, you know, because children, you know, I think it's you know, globally known, children are innocent. These kids, you know, didn't ask to be brought here. You know, they need to be taken care of and protected. And you can see it. I mean, it's evident, you know, in the clothes that they wear, that I wouldn't say all of them are malnourished, but you could just see the way that this is affecting them. It's these kids will never be the same, you know?
Mm.
So that's just, I have children. I have 6 children, and my kids are everything to me. I would, you know, bend over backwards for my kids, whatever it took. But to see these kids living like this, I mean, playing in rubble and, you know, ammunition, it's amazing.
Do you know that Israel was sending drones, those unmanned drones with cameras on them, into Gaza? And the children who are playing on top of buildings, are playing soccer or something, someone in Tel Aviv, miles and miles away, would manipulate that drone and shoot down the children. That was documented. It was documented by the British newspaper, The Guardian.
Right.
They've also assaulted the medical teams that were out there trying to help people.
Right.
And prevented them from helping the wounded or taking them into hospitals.
Right.
So you walked among the rubble?
We did. We actually, it's that you mentioned the ambulances. We actually saw the bombed out ambulances. That's, I mean, it was as if it was business as usual, you know, to not allow an ambulance to go and pick up somebody that you just, you know, wounded is, I mean, it's
criminal.
It is criminal. It should be a war crime. It's we saw several bombed out ambulances.
There was a family, a whole family was told by soldiers when they invaded Gaza to go to another building because they were going to occupy that building. So they told them to go to another building. And then the following day, bombarded that building and killed them all. There were instances, documented instances, of people coming out waving a white flag.
Right.
They were women with their children, waving a white flag.
Right.
Shot.
Unbelievable.
The events there were absolutely barbaric.
They were. You have Israeli soldiers coming out now, and I can't think of the guy's name, but he's I think an instructor in Israel, and he's been, you know, leaking this information that these Israeli soldiers were told basically to kill as many civilians as possible. It's unimaginable at this. You know, and to think that, you know, we have a government that support that just, I mean, knows it's going on, but could care less. Just, you know, it's just amazing.
Supports them, funds them,
provides
the ammunition and the high-tech experimental weaponry that they want to try on the Palestinians.
Yeah,
the dime bomb. The white phosphor.
Right. Whiskey Pete, they call it.
Pardon me?
They have like a name for it. It's Whiskey Pete, the white phosphorus. They were using it in Iraq.
Yeah.
Against the heavily civilian, you know, populated areas.
Yeah. And of course, whatever America does is okay for others to imitate. What would you like to tell American people, young people your age? Would you encourage them to go and see for themselves what is going on?
Absolutely. I feel it's my duty to, you know, to speak out. I can't harbor this information. I think once you go there and you see what's being done in your name, you know, like Americans, we live a good life. We like to think that, you know, we have a bed, we have bills, we have this to worry about, that to worry about. But we live a very privileged life. I would say 90-some-odd% of us, you know, I'm not just talking about that. We know that that there's the very wealthy, and most people here in the United States are not living in a war zone, in a live war zone, and being starved and being, you know, bombed to smithereens, you know, your children dying. We sit and watch American Idol and Dancing with the Stars. You know, we're a reality TV people. And I just think we need to wake up. We're being led like sheep. You know, we should think for ourselves. We should look into different governments and what these governments represent. You know, we should not support any racist government like Israel. We should, as Americans, stand up and say that this is our country. You know, why let it be, you know, led down this path? You know, I mean, we're hated around the world not because of our freedoms, but because we do everything in our power to make sure that freedom exists nowhere. And we really need to wake up. So I'm trying to, you know, slowly but surely speak to my friends, my family. You know, the one thing most people say is, you know, why God? There's suffering everywhere. And my response to that is, you have to start somewhere. It's that attitude that will get you to never to respond to anything, because, you know, it's there's bad everywhere. But that's no excuse. You know, that's we need to get from in front of this TV and start to do something. You know,
before you went there, Aswad, you obviously were watching news broadcasts on,
yes,
CNN and Fox and others. What image did you have of Israel, and what image did you have of Palestinians before you went?
That's a very good question. I have followed the conflict for some time now. I think it's pretty well known, you know, globally, that the Palestinians are being, you know, they're having their land stolen from them, you know, and that they're basically being put in concentration camps. But, you know, I've heard about, you know, these refugee camp massacres, and, you know, I have never seen it with my own eyes. So,
have you seen it in the media in this country?
Very little of it. I think this last war was very different from every other. You know, Israel tried its best to keep Western journalists out because they didn't want that. Not that CNN would broadcast it anyway. They may show you a burning car, but they're not going to show you. You know, I was on the internet, and I saw the kids being pulled from the rubble. I saw a baby who was charred. I mean, up to this baby had to be no more than 6 months old, and was, I mean, scorched up to her waist because she was hit with this white phosphorus. You know, the little girl who was buried up to her neck with the rebar, you know, coming out and bent around her. That image right there is just, I was sitting at my desk at work, and I had, you know, I get these news clips that come up, and I had saw that image, and I couldn't help myself. You know, I just broke down in tears. Like, I wasn't, like, beside myself, but I had to get up and go to the bathroom because I you know, what do you do when you see something like that, you know?
What was the image of Israel in your mind? Did it have this polished image of being, you know, a highly advanced moral society that was facing terrorists and that all Palestinians were terrorists? Is that the image that you got before you went?
No, I wouldn't say that. I didn't know much about Israel. You know, I do know that the United Nations decided to partition Palestine basically because of this is what I had thought, because of what had happened to, you know, the Jewish people during the Second World War and what they were subjected to. You know, they were basically given part of Palestine to create their own state. But that's all I don't, you know, I have Jewish friends, but, you know, I've never had any problems with any Jewish people. So I didn't see them as, I guess this last war really woke me up. It showed me what they're really doing, because we don't have a good view of them here. You know, we're fed what they want to feed us, basically. You know, I really didn't know. But I think I know now.
What happened in Gaza was not a war. And it is not really a conflict. It is all one-sided. It is just one side that wants all the land, wants to expel everyone, wants to take it over, and uses its powerful military forces to attack civilian population centers. It's not a war. A war implies that there are two sides. There is a side that that is fighting the other. And what you have are civilians, just like the Minutemen were in this country fighting the British. You have a bunch of civilians who were called to arms in times of emergency. Palestine doesn't have an army. It doesn't have a single plane. It doesn't have a single tank. So, you know, it's wrong to, in a way, to cast it as the media have in this country
as a
war. It's not a war, and it's not a conflict. It's not an Arab-Israeli conflict. It is an Israeli deliberate attempt to expel all Palestinians and annex their land. This is an obscene spectacle that we have seen many times, not just in the West Bank. You see it every day in the West Bank, where villages are raided on some trumped-up charge. And we've seen it in its most obscene character in Gaza.
Right.
Well,
it's unbelievable.
Let me ask you, Aswad, if you have any last thoughts you want to share with us. Because we are coming up on our... we're coming up short of time.
Okay. I would like to just ask anyone listening to put themselves in the position of a Palestinian. You know, it's. I think it's important that we try to identify with what, you know, they're going through. We owe it to them. I mean, it's our government that's supporting this. Without American involvement, this would not be going on. I mean, I think it's important that most people acknowledge that, you know, and start to do something about it. I'm not speaking because I've done this before. This is something I'm just getting into myself, so it's not, you know, like I've had a history of this. I'm learning myself, but I think it's important that we at least take that first step. Visit Gaza. Don't do the Disneyland or the other, the family vacation. Go and visit somewhere that our tax dollar, supports. And I think it would change their life as well.
Thank you, sir.
No problem, Sharif. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for being our guest today.
You're welcome, and thank you.
And that does it for today. We wish our listeners a pleasant and restful weekend, and look forward to having you with us next week, same time. Until then, this is Sharif Fahm signing off for now and reminding our listeners to get involved. Go to Palestine and see for yourselves how our hard-earned tax dollars to the tune of $15 million are being given to Israel every day to finance the killing of Palestinian civilians, the destruction of Palestinian society with aircraft and weaponry supplied by the United States, when we could use every penny right here in the United States, amongst many other things, to help Americans who have lost their jobs, provide health care for the millions of Americans who can't afford health care, and help provide education to American children. The United States gives Israel between $5 and $6 billion a year. $5 to $6 billion a year provides millions of unemployment checks, can provide home foreclosure relief for thousands and tens of thousands of homes, yet we spend it for killing. Thank you, and until next week.